What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothian-McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting! From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette,
the political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello, podcast listeners. I'm Connor, and welcome to this week's episode of Intelligence Squared. Today, we're joined by Nigel Ingster, author of the new book, The Great Decoupling, China, America, and the Race for Technological Supremacy. And in the episode, Nigel spoke to Linda Yu, the economist and broadcaster, about how the race for developing technologies like artificial intelligence will shape the geopolitics of the 21st century. It's a fascinating conversation, and if you do enjoy it, you can find a link for Nigel's book in the podcast description. But now, let's go to the episode.
Hello, I'm Linda Yu, an economist and broadcaster. Welcome to this episode of the Intelligence Squared podcast. I'm joined by Nigel Ingster, senior advisor at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. He's the former director of operations and intelligence at MI6, the secret intelligence service of the British government. We're here to discuss his new book, The Great Decoupling, China, America, and the Struggle for Technological Supremacy. Welcome, Nigel. Let me just start off by asking you why you wrote this book, because you actually write in your own introduction, you had never planned to write this book or any book on China. So what changed your mind?
Well, thanks very much, Linda. I had written a book about China before for IISS called China's Cyberpower, which came out in 2016. And I thought at that point that I'd said everything I had to say on the subject. But when Michael Dwyer, the editor of Hearst, got in touch with me and asked if I'd be interested in doing something, that coincided with the beginning of a year when I'd made a New Year's resolution not to read any more bad and unnecessary books by Western commentators about China. But having thought about it, I concluded that the situation had moved on sufficiently, both in terms of geopolitics and technology and the nexus between the two, that there probably was the need for something to set all of this in context. It coincided with a period when it was obvious that attitudes in the United States toward China had undergone a sea change. I'd been at a conference at the beginning of the year of 2018 when it became absolutely clear to me that the prevailing consensus in the USA was starting to be that engagement with China had been a failure, that that things needed to change. The United States was in danger of being overwhelmed because they'd failed to recognize how fast China's technological progress would be, and they needed to do something about it. And I thought at that point there was probably a need to set all these issues in context and to kind of look back to through history to a point where China had been the kind of uncontested technology superpower of the planet, responsible for about half of all pre-industrial revolution era inventions, and really kind of the head of the pack, and start from there, then look at the dramatic decline that China underwent in the 19th century and see if that could explain why China is now behaving in the way that it is and why the race for technology supremacy matters so much.
That's a great lead-in, actually, to my next question, which is for you to outline the argument of your book. So what do you mean by the great decoupling?
Well, it's actually a phrase that I borrowed from a colleague of mine. One of the other things I do is work for a small economic consultancy called Enodo Economics, run by a lady called Diana Shoileva. And she has actually coined the term the Great Decoupling, and I shamelessly purloined it with her approval. And what I mean by it is essentially a kind of parting, of a fundamental parting of the ways between the United States as the incumbent hegemon and China as the rising power that, whether by accident or design, is in practice starting to challenge US claims to hegemony. And what we've seen in starting in 2018 with the US-China trade war and a so-called US-China tech war that came out of that has been an effort by the United States both to slow down China's technology progress and to seek to disengage from what has become a very high level of interdependence. And that interdependence goes back a long way. It really does go back to the late 1970s, early 1980s, when Deng Xiaoping initiated China's period of economic reform and this mission to kind of catch up with and, by implication, in due course, overtake the West in Chinese Ganchao. And we've seen during the 1990s and early 2000s an almost symbiotic relationship evolving between the United States and China in both economy and technology. You know, what Mervyn King referred to the late period in the late 1990s to 2008, the financial crisis, as the nice decade, by which he meant non-inflationary, constantly expansionary. I mean, he wasn't, you know, extolling this as something, you know, to be carried on. His point was that it was unsustainable. But for a while, we saw this kind of symbiotic relationship. China made everything. The USA bought it. China put all its savings in U.S. treasuries, you know, enabling U.S. consumers to buy things on credit, which was cheap and available, until, of course, the party had to end. It ran out. Meanwhile, China, which had somewhat reluctantly, but, you know, out of necessity, embarked on digitization, development of digital capabilities and a digital economy, initially heavily reliant upon US technology, but very rapidly moving to become the kind of world's workshop in the lower end technology, to the point where now the United States realizes that it's outsourced so much basic manufacturing that it is actually vulnerable. And this is something that the coronavirus pandemic, of course, has highlighted. The you know, there are certain facilities, you know, the capabilities, the manufacturing capabilities the United States no longer has. And this became evident not just in the pandemic, but also in areas like fifth generation mobile technology, 5G. You know, most of the concepts, most of the software, most of the difficult stuff around 5G is very much in American hands. But what American companies can't do is, you know, do basic manufacture of things like base repeating stations. All that is now in China's hands. So you've got this very, very complex nexus between the United States and China, driven by the desire of Wall Street and big tech to achieve high levels of efficiency at the expense of resilience and redundancy. And people are now starting to recognize the vulnerabilities associated with that and are having to try and address them. We're seeing now in the United States, the US government is putting pressure on US technology companies to move away from China, to cease their collaboration with China. Silicon Valley is not keen to do this. You know, they value very highly the business that they do with China. They make a lot of money out of it and they get a lot of benefit from it. And of course, we're also now seeing Wall Street barreling in to the China market as China opens its capital account to foreign investment, which may prove to be a relatively short and temporary thing. My sense is that having got the capital and got the risk management expertise that they need, you know, the message from China is likely to be, in the words of Douglas Adams, goodbye and thanks for all the fish. But for the time being, everybody, you know, wants to be in there. So we've got a situation in which the US government, for geopolitical and strategic reasons, is pulling in one direction, Silicon Valley and Wall Street, to some extent, pulling in the other direction. And it's very amusing. It doesn't come in the book, but it's interesting to note that one of Huawei, you know, the Chinese technology national champion that was the driver for 5G technology, that Ericsson, the competitor of Huawei, the CEO of Ericsson, has spent most of 2020 lobbying the Swedish government not to exclude Huawei from Sweden's 5G network, because, of course, Ericsson is heavily dependent upon Chinese inputs, Chinese components, and doesn't want to get on the wrong side of the Chinese government, which I think, you know, kind of illustrates, you know, the complexity and the sort of wickedness of the problem that we're now facing.
That's a great encapsulation, actually, of the, as you say, it's a very entangled relationship that is decoupling for different reasons. And I want to explore the extent of it, obviously, which is what you write about in your book. But before we do that, I'd be very keen to know why you think technology and not, say, other sources of competition. Why is technology at the heart of the US-China rivalry?
Well, I think it's a function of the way in which digitalization has changed quite fundamentally the way in which we do so much. It really has kind of changed the terms of trade. I mean, you know, obviously, you know, China was working hard and relatively successfully to modernize its economy using, shall we say, pre-information era capabilities. But even back in the 1980s, China's leaders were well aware of how digitalization was going to change everything. You know, they compulsively read the works of Alvin Toffler. And I remember when I was in Beijing in the mid-1980s, as think tanks and university departments were slowly reopening after the Cultural Revolution, that's the one thing they always wanted you to do for them was to give them lots of copies of Alvin Toffler's books, Third Wave and Future Shock. But, you know, Toffler was on the money on this, and the Chinese leadership worked out very quickly that digitalization was going to be critical to modernization and competitiveness. And I think that China's embrace of digitalization, although it did cause them quite serious political and security problems to start with, has resulted in outcomes which exceeded our expectations, but almost certainly also exceeded the expectations of China's own leadership in terms of how far and how fast China could go. And now I think it's quite clear to everybody that control of, domination of technologies like fifth generation mobile technology, like artificial intelligence, quantum computing, quantum encryption, etc., you know, whoever dominates those capabilities effectively holds the key to the future. And, you know, this has been made abundantly clear in speech after speech after speech by Xi Jinping, basically urging everyone on, saying, you know, guys, we've got to, you know, we've got to, you know, the message is, you know, we've got a narrow window of opportunity to pull this off. We have missed the boat so many times in the past, we can't afford to do it again. Whereas, you know, the United States, as the incumbent power, still very much dominant in all these technologies, I think is approaching it from a very different perspective. In China, everything is state-driven, you know, top-down. In the United States, all these technologies are being developed by a private sector which is very jealous of its independence from government and far from amenable to government direction. And you look at the big US tech companies, Apple, Google, Microsoft, etc. These are organizations and entities which in effect have foreign policies more consequential in some respects than those of the US government. And China's finding this too, actually, at the moment, which is why they're trying to clip Jack Ma's wings somewhat at the moment. But no, and I think technology is clearly, or domination of technology is seen now as the key differentiator, which is going to make the difference between success and failure and relative standing internationally in terms of economy and global power.
Mm. And indeed, I want to make sure we get to this, but it feeds into their intelligence capability. So it feeds into national security and all the other sort of arenas of competition. But before we talk more about Chinese tech, tell me about China's glass heart. You write about the example of the U.S. National Basketball Association. So do say a bit about that, because I think that sets the stage also for some of China's stance.
Indeed. Well, I think that China has come a remarkable distance in a remarkably short time. I mean, no other country has done anything like this in the timescale in which China has achieved it. And I don't think any other country could. China was very fortunate to be positioned in a unique conjunction of circumstances that probably aren't going to be replicated by anybody else. But the fact is, they've done it. They had their opportunity, they took it, and the results have unquestionably been impressive. But I think it's becoming increasingly clear to China that although people recognize their achievements, they don't seem ready to recognize China as a kind of peer in the international system. And I think this is particularly true of the United States and, to a lesser degree, other developed Western countries, that as long as China is being run by a communist party with its own very distinctive blend of sort of Leninist nationalism, one can coin all sorts of phrases to try and describe it, that they're never going to really afford China the respect that China feels that it deserves. And I think this has given rise to a kind of, I say in the book, almost adolescent prickliness. Why won't people, give us the respect that we think we're due? Why won't they, sort of accept us on equal footing with themselves? But I think it's also a reflection of the Chinese party state's own inherent insecurities. This is an organization that is not prepared to submit itself to any kind of electoral process. It regards itself as having won the right to rule China, if you like, by right of conquest almost. But in order to do this, they need to keep the people on their side. And they need to do this, firstly, by enhancing their standards of living, but also by demonstrating that the party and the party alone can defend China's interests and honor internationally. And this is really not about, this is not a process that's been driven by China's diplomats. It's really driven by China's party apparatchiks, whose knowledge of international affairs is minimal to non-existent, and they don't really care, because what this is really all about in the final analysis is keeping their own people on side. And this, I think, is why we see this prickliness, in Chinese, as you put it, the glass heart, bo li xian, and the emergence of the famed wolf warrior diplomats communicating with the world in very undiplomatic terms. I think it is all about this desire internally for stability, externally for recognition, and as I said, the respect which China feels that its achievements entitle it to enjoy.
And that's what the Basketball Association ended up running up against the glass heart. And of course, as you've outlined, where there is tension with the between US and China, US companies, including sports teams, view China's commercial market as something that, you know, is very attractive. So I think that gives another illustration of that. And you've also outlined how China's digitalization has progressed and in some senses surpassed what maybe the leaders had themselves expected. So do say a bit more about when China went digital and tell the story you write about in the book about the pirated copies of Windows XP and how that led Microsoft to give free upgrades.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, China, you know, China joined the internet in 1996, which, relatively speaking, was late on. And to start with, you know, there was relatively limited uptake, you know, only a couple of million people in amongst this huge population. And this at a time when, you know, nobody had computers, smartphones were still a distant dream, and even ordinary telephone lines were in relatively short supply. But things moved very quickly, and particularly once smartphones arrived. You know, most people in China didn't have their own laptops, their own computers. They used internet cafes. But once cheap smartphones arrived, that changed very quickly. And what we had in China was an interesting situation in which the government was driving the development of the internet through a series of top-down initiatives, but at the same time creating an enabling environment in which Chinese entrepreneurs and engineers, many of whom had kind of served some kind of apprenticeship in Silicon Valley, were able to come back to China with the skills that they had acquired and adapt them in ways that were uniquely suited to China's particular circumstances. So, for example, we've seen nobody in China has ever really had credit cards, nor now is there any need, because people like Jack Ma and Alibaba, you know, and Tencent developed mobile banking systems that essentially enabled people to leapfrog the credit card and move to a world, you know, of electronic payments now so pervasive that, as I mentioned even in the book, even beggars in the street have notices around their necks with QR codes so you can give them a digital donation. And, you know, Chinese entrepreneurs have not been particularly innovative in terms of the you know, the foundational science of this thing, but what they've been really good at is developing applications that help smooth out all the frictions of daily life in urban China. And the extent to which they've been good at this is demonstrated by the way in which, for example, eBay was comprehensively run out of town by Chinese competitors. You know, eBay thought that they could just deal with China as another country in a worldwide network operated out of America. And that simply, you know, wasn't good enough to cope with the conditions within China. So we've seen, you know, this very interesting process. And every time digitalization looked like flagging, losing momentum, we saw another top-level push to move it forward. What are the problems? What are the things we've got to do? Do we need more regulation? Do we need, you know, better control of data? What is it that we need to do? And they kind of got on and done it. And we saw this particularly when Xi Jinping took office in 2012. One of the first things he did was to set up a leading small group, since become a commission, on information security and digitalization. And this is one of, you know, the sort of seven commissions that Xi Jinping personally chairs, where he's really sort of driving the system to deliver, you know, better and faster results. And yes, initially, of course, China was very heavily dependent upon US technology. And pirated Windows software was kind of the default setting, pervasive in government departments, among the PLA, everybody else. And Microsoft said that they were no longer going to support a particular version of Microsoft. You know, this was potentially devastating for China. And in the event, Microsoft had to give ground and say, okay, we'll give free upgrades to everybody who was using this. You know, we know it's pirated software. And, you know, that's what they had to do. And the interesting thing is, of course, that Microsoft is still very heavily involved in providing services to the Chinese market. And we see it also with Google. I mean, Huawei has, you know, been cut off from access to Google and Android. And so they've developed their own system. But that system looks suspiciously like Android. Indeed, I don't think you could probably tell, you know, much difference in terms of functionality. So it's been a very interesting process. But, you know, as the vulnerabilities of dependence on US technology have become more evident, and of course this was dramatically illustrated by the Snowden revelations in 2012. You know, so the push has been as far as possible to move in the direction of indigenous manufacture. We've seen the emergence of Made in China 2025, though latterly, I think the references to Made in China 25 have disappeared down the memory hole because they're seen as neuralgic in terms of relations with the USA. But the push is on for indigenous manufacture, and nowhere is this more evident than in the area of high-end microprocessors, microchips, which the USA is now denying China access to, and which are critical for many of the things that China wants to see achieved. So we're seeing huge amounts of money being thrown at this particular problem. I don't know how successful it's going to be, but also we're seeing huge amounts of money being thrown at artificial intelligence, quantum computing, etc., etc.
Because you mentioned just now as well that the People's Liberation Army, so there are military uses of AI, and that's obviously another sphere of competition. And you actually write in the book that espionage is a gray area in international law. So just outline for us what China does in this area globally.
Well, yes, it's very interesting because for a long time after liberation, China's intelligence services didn't really amount to much. You know, they had a reputation that really wasn't supported by any particular performance. That began to change in the 1980s as China opened up and the world became more accessible. And in particular, the intelligence services were able to leverage the benefits that came from a Chinese diaspora community in the United States that was disproportionately represented in a lot of high-end government technology programs. So, you know, that was relatively successful. But digitalization has really quite fundamentally changed kind of the terms of the debate. And we began to see in the mid-2000s, you know, the Chinese intelligence services waking up to the realization that in the West, there were huge volumes of data stored on servers that were either poorly protected or not protected at all, and were more or less there for the taking. And at that point, we began to see terabytes of data being extracted from US corporations and other Western corporations around the world, you know, massive volumes of data. Initially, a lot of the companies who were being attacked either were not aware that this was happening or were aware that it was happening, but didn't want anybody to do anything about it because they feared that if they did complain, they would be subject to retaliation by the Chinese state. And they were right, because there were plenty of examples of that happening. When companies like Cisco and Intel, you know, raised complaints, all of a sudden, you know, these companies found themselves being investigated for all sorts of alleged offences in China. So it was actually very difficult for the US or indeed any other Western government to start to mount an effective response because, you know, there weren't enough plaintiffs around to, you know, to kind of do it. But the volume of this data extraction reached such levels where I think people had to address it. It had become, particularly with the United States, a strategic issue in its own right. I mean, espionage, you know, is pervasive. It's happening all the time, even as we speak. And in the main, it's not doing that much harm. And I always say to my Chinese colleagues when I go there, there are two types of espionage. There's good espionage and there's bad espionage. And you guys are doing too much of the bad variety and not enough of the good. You know, what I mean by that is, you know, good espionage is really, you know, getting under the skin of the other guy, understanding where he's coming from, why he does what he does, because that way you can actually mitigate risks and avoid accidents. But what you're doing is actually creating problems, and this was certainly true for the United States, and the United States under Obama did try to do something about it. In 2015, you know, they forced China to the negotiating table and got them to agree not to conduct espionage for economic benefit. But actually, China didn't really. I mean, you know, the US said, look, you know, there's a difference between, you know, what in my business we used to call ordinary decent espionage, you know, sort of collecting national security secrets versus collecting information for economic gain. Well, for China, this was a distinction that they did not recognize, because for China, national security is seen as far more comprehensive in scope than typically it is in the West. And, you know, now under Xi Jinping in China, national security encompasses things like culture, literature, you know, as well as many of the all the traditional areas. So China was never really persuaded of this. And in private, they would say, well, you know what, this is basically condign punishment for the 100 years of national humiliation that you guys subjected us to. So, you know, get over it, in essence. I mean, that was always in private, never, you know, made public, of course. But we did get a sort of brief kind of tactical pause, but it didn't last very long. And we're now seeing that data extraction is a huge undertaking for China now. And we've seen massive attacks, not just against private sector companies, but against government. One I reference in the book is the theft of the US government's operation of personal management database, which contains highly sensitive personal information about nearly 25 million US government employees. That information is now being analyzed and triaged in a data center somewhere in Hebei. I can't remember where. I did know where it was. And it's being mixed together with all sorts of other information, travel data, credit data stolen from Experian, et cetera, in ways that enable the Chinese state to build very granular pictures of individual Americans, which they can potentially use for the purposes of espionage, political pressure, detecting U.S. Intelligence officers, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not just that, of course, but in today's world, if you can aggregate enough data and subject it to analysis through artificial intelligence programs, you may well be able to find out things about your adversary in terms of vulnerabilities that they themselves aren't aware of.
So you're saying this is happening all around us, even as we speak?
Oh, very much so, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. And as with so much else again about China, the scale on which it's being done is qualitatively different from anything that we've ever seen before.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind, so you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared, so many great chats to enrich the mind like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You write in the book about examples of how this has been done, especially against the United States. But is this also the case for the UK or other countries?
Any Western country that has information of potential use to China is vulnerable to this. If you like, to use old-style Cold War terminology, for China, the USA is the main enemy. That is where the key focus of intelligence effort is directed. But there's plenty else to go around. The Ministry of State Security is a big organization, probably about 100,000 employees. And China still also has its own separate military intelligence capabilities. But the point I also make in the book is that we kind of need to think about China differently from ordinary states. In Western democracies, intelligence services do operate, but they operate in some ways at the margins of the state. In a country like the United Kingdom, for example, the intelligence service has no ability to compel ordinary British citizens to work for it. They can ask, but if the answer is no, then they have to accept that and move on. In China, what we've got is a situation where China has become a kind of techno-security state, but also an intelligence state, a bit like the Venetian Republic was around the 16th and 17th century, when intelligence, collection of covert information and the practice of covert activity was sort of baked into the fabric of the state. It was integral to the state's functioning, and any Venetian citizen could potentially and might well find themselves being involved in some aspect of covert activity designed to assist the Venetian Republic. And so it is now, I think, with China. It's an intelligent state. It's a different phenomenon.
And I think that feeds into your overall argument as we sort of wrap up this discussion about the great decoupling, because it's both the competition side, but it's also that the Chinese and the American systems, and indeed the Chinese system versus what you've just described in the West, is so very different. So you argue that the great decoupling, you write in the book, has already begun, and that Democrats with the new Biden administration won't change that very much. So just outline the ways in which China, the United States have already decoupled, what you expect is coming down the line, and what does it mean for the rest of us?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think, as I say in the book, decoupling is not going to be a smooth process, with clearly defined binary outcomes. It's something that's going to happen in a very, sort of piecemeal and rather jagged way. And, it's interesting in China now, the term decoupling, tuago, is almost a dirty word. It almost has connotations of like child abuse. Whereas, in the United States, in political circles, it's seen as something as necessary and, desirable and necessary. China does not want to decouple. I mean, it's a very interesting situation. China wants engagement with the world, but it wants that engagement to be much more on its own terms and in accordance with its own rules and preferences. For the United States, it seems increasingly, at least in political circles, that the U.S. Sees salvation in disengaging from China, in ring-fencing some key areas of economic and technology activity, to kind of insulate them from the potential for Chinese interference. Now, whether that actually is either possible or desirable is a moot point, and I don't try to reach a judgment on that in the book, because I think it's too, there are far too many moving parts, too many unpredictabilities, and it's just, too goddamn complicated, in a word. But I think that what we will see is a kind of selective disengagement in certain areas, some of which will probably have to be tacitly acknowledged as necessary, and telecommunications, I think, is an obvious case where both sides may have to accept that something like this is going to happen, and we're going to have to learn to live with it. That the days of total U.S. dependence on China as the kind of workshop of the world have to end. That the United States and other Western economies are going to have to relearn the art of making some things for themselves, or at least having alternative sources of supply, so we don't have this kind of single point of failure problem that we had last year with, for example, masks and protective medical equipment. So, these things are going to change. I think we're going to see a situation in which both China and Western countries are much warier about each other, less engaged, less inclined to just engage at all costs, to think through much more carefully the strategic and geopolitical implications of such activity. We've seen it with the European Union, have recategorized China as being lots of different things, including being a strategic competitor. And so I think that that will happen. Quite how far it goes is ultimately, I think, going to be driven by politics, geopolitics, but also domestic politics. We've seen in the last year that the Trump administration has really piled on the pressure on China in many ways, really trying to constrain China and also, so to speak, poke them in the eye over matters like Taiwan. But also, in ways that seek to box in the incoming administration and limit its room for manoeuvre in relation to China. Now, it's far too early to tell how that is going to play out. But we all know that when it comes to the United States, when the tanker has turned through 180 degrees, it has turned, and you tend to get a very quick national consensus developing, which is then very hard to shift in the absence of dramatic events. So my sense is that for the foreseeable future, we're going to see a United States that is looking to disengage at least partially from China in various ways, and a China that will try to prevent this, but will ultimately have to accept it. And how far it goes, and what the implications are. I mean, my sense is that, when it comes to technology and human progress, the likely outcome is that everybody loses. My worst fears, I don't know whether they'll be realized, is that China may again turn in on itself. When all is said and done in China, security always trumps everything else when life gets difficult. But I also worry about whether the United States will be able to continue its recent spurt of inventiveness in some of these technologies, not least when we see the prevalence of anti-science mindsets in the US political class. I mean, I think what happened to China in the 19th century should be an object lesson for all of us. Here was a country that was kind of on top of the world and saw itself as on top of the world, and all of a sudden went from hero to zero, literally overnight. We shouldn't think it can't happen to us.
Wow, Nigel. Well, finally, I'd like to conclude on a hopeful note. Tell me why you write in the book you don't think we're headed into a new Cold War.
Well, I mean, I think a Cold War is a very poor analogy for what is happening now, because, I mean, I lived through the Cold War. It was a defining element in my earlier professional career. And, back then, the Soviet Union, I mean, we used to talk about the Soviet Union as, very politically incorrect terms, upper volta with the bomb. A third world economy that just happened to have, sufficient nuclear missiles to destroy the planet. It was cut off from the rest of the world. It was, largely a sealed system. It was, the Soviet Union was the world's biggest open prison. And its economic impact on the world, economic engagement with the world, was minimal to non-existent. China could not be more different in that regard. Firstly, its economic impact and its level of economic engagement with the world is orders of magnitude different. But also from an ideological perspective, it's not quite the same. The Soviet Union, at least on paper, was dedicated to making the world, communist in effect. Whereas I think the kind of sort of Leninist nationalism that we're seeing, the Chinese Communist Party now espousing, doesn't really aspire to do that. Certainly the language of the party state is Marxist-Leninist language, and the sort of methodology of thinking, dialectic materialism, all that sort of thing, is very recognizable. But it's also born up with a kind of nationalism that's almost more reminiscent of National Socialism in the 1930s in Europe. And it's very interesting that some of the ideologues that seem to be shaping current thinking see Carl Schmitt as one of their sort of key Western frames of reference. Because Carl Schmitt was for 3 years, I think, a member of the German National Socialist Party. So it's a very different thing. It's much more ethnically based. China needs to be dealt with in a very different way from the way that the Soviet Union needs to be dealt with. We can't cut it out. We can't exclude it. China has got to be dealt with. China has got to be engaged with. I don't think there is any realistic alternative to that. And the kind of rather crude tactics that we used in the Cold War are not going to cut it. I think we need, you know, in the West to, you know, to have a much more nuanced and sophisticated strategy for dealing with China. At a recent conference involving US military, I made the point that if the USA wants to engage with like-minded countries to consider how to deal with the China challenge, they're going to have to accept a degree of variable geometry. You know, the idea that all other, you know, Western democracies are going to view China in exactly the same way that the United States might do is completely unrealistic. And, you know, therefore, we're going to have to look at this in a very different way. And I think actually what we need to do as well is kind of use China as a mirror to hold up to ourselves and ask ourselves, you know, what China is doing right that, you know, from which we might, you know, take the odd lesson. I fantasize about an era in which Western politicians understand China as well as they understand America, and dare I venture to suggest even have some facility in the Chinese language, but I don't think that's about to happen anytime soon, regrettably. But I think that, you know, as I said, it's not going to be a Cold War like the Cold War was. This is not a realistic option. You know, power has shifted. Power has shifted from east to west, but power has also dispersed. You know, we're seeing actually quite a lot of medium-sized countries showing a capacity to exercise power much greater than would traditionally have been the case. So we're going to have to look at a very different global distribution of power, of which China is a key component, but not the only one, and think about how we deal with that. We don't have that template yet. We don't have that blueprint. But hopefully in the next few years, we can start to develop one.
Mm. Thanks very much, Nigel Inkster. And do pick up his book, The Great Decoupling, China, America, and the Struggle for Technological Supremacy, to gain a better understanding of what is likely to be the defining event of the early 21st century. So thanks very much to Nigel, and thanks to all of you for tuning in. For more podcasts, please go to intelligencesquared.com. I'm Linda Yu.